This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
And away we go. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium, Christos Anesti, to all of my Orthodox Christian friends, family, and listeners. Christos Anesti, Christ is risen. Alithos Anesti, indeed, he has risen. Speaking of the resurrection, the Shroud of Turin will be featured in our weekly trivia question at the bottom of the hour, and your chance to win a pair of tickets to my live stage event, Follow the Truth 2, happening Sunday, April the 26th at the Regent Theater in Oshawa. That's an evening event. Just 2 weeks remaining. So please, if you haven't already done so and you plan on attending, call the box office this week and order your tickets. We really want to fill the Regent Theater. It's going to be a night to remember. And think about this. You'll never find these seven remarkable speakers under one roof again, in all likelihood. Someone speaking about the Zapruder film, the Lost Tribes of Israel, electronic harassment, remote viewing, spirit communication, the Shroud of Turin, and UFOs. Again, all in one evening under one roof. For more information, visit followthetruth.tv, and again, call the box office at 905-721-3399. We are doing another hangout on air tonight, so if you'd like to join the live stream, get on up to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett. Be sure to follow and say hi, at Richard Serrett. Click on the link. I guess it's about three tweets down. It says, tonight, April 12th, HOA. That's the link. You just click on that and you are in. Just want to mention the Conspiracy Show app. We are working on one and it's getting close. Albert, the intern, and I were speaking with the developer this past week, and we are very excited about it. It's just an incredible app, and we're going to be launching it sometime this spring. It'll be available for your smartphones and your tablets, again, very soon. So stand by for our official launch. And I want to thank Sharon Foster and Albert for all their work on that. And Eric, the intern, is here in studio. He's been very busy uploading audio from all our past shows. And now I'm very happy to announce you can go back all the way to the summer of 2012 and listen to all the previous shows of The Conspiracy Show. All you have to do, subscribe. It's fast, it's easy, and free. To register, just click on the blue member area button. The blue member area button on the left-hand side of richardserrett.com. Answer a few quick questions, and you are a member. It is one of the seminal cases of alien abduction. Most of us, I would gather, are familiar with the Betty and Barney Hill alien abduction. That was the American couple allegedly abducted by extraterrestrials in a rural portion of New Hampshire back in September of 1961. But perhaps, I would argue, the best documented case of its kind to date is the Betty Andreessen encounter of 1967. in the city of Ashburnham, Massachusetts, on the night of January 25th, one of the most celebrated cases of UFO abduction began. Betty Andreessen was working in her kitchen while her seven children, mother and father, were in the living room. Shortly after 6:30, the lights in the house briefly blinked. Immediately thereafter, a reddish light began to beam through the kitchen window. The sudden darkness in the house set the kids' nerves on edge, and Betty ran to comfort them. Her father ran into the kitchen to peer out the window and find the source of the unusual light. To his utter shock, he saw five odd-looking beings coming toward the house in a, well, with a hopping motion. And so it began almost 40 years ago. And here to tell the remarkable story is Betty Andreessen Luca and her husband, Bob Luca. Welcome to you both. Welcome to the Conspiracy Show.
Thank you so much.
Yes, and hello to your listeners.
A pleasure to have you with us. Wow, it's been, well, nearly 38 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I gave a very brief synopsis of what happened. Betty, if I could get you to just take us back to that date and fill in some of those blanks.
Okay. Well, after my father had rushed past me, I was not aware of it, but he went into the pantry area, and the pantry was the kitchen plus a half wall, and then the cabinets and the sink was located in the other half. And I could not see that he was there, but there's a window right in the front, and as you said, he was the first, actually, to see the five beings coming down the hill, and I was not aware of that until later. But when I came into the kitchen, because I thought the reddish-orange light was either the fire department or the police department out there, and so I thought something was going on. I went into the kitchen, and as I was standing there, all of a sudden, five strange-looking beings entered my home right through the wooden door. They were standing there. They were dressed in a blue suit. They had, like, a belt and a sash across their chest, and there was sort of an emblem on their shoulder, on their arm. And they had a large head, gray skin, and large, dark eyes. And this was very fearful to me at first, but immediately scripture went into my mind, entertain the stranger, for it may be angels unaware. And this gave me peace and comfort, so all of a sudden, everything was all right. And the beings that stood there, the leader said to me that they were there and they wanted I thought at first, through the mind, they were communicating to me, and I thought they wanted something to eat. And so I went to the refrigerator, got some meat, and I put it in the frying pan, began to cook it. And when that happened, the leader jumped back as if startled. And then through the mind, I heard them say, no, 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 we want knowledge tried by fire.
Oh, hang on. This is interesting, fascinating. First of all, they were communicating with you telepathically.
Yes.
But your first instinct, I mean, obviously, you know, mother of seven children, you must be an incredibly nurturing person, and your first instinct was to cook for these five humanoids that had just appeared in your home out of thin air.
Right. Well, the scripture was what went through my mind, and so I thought, well, this might be angels because of the scripture. And who was I to say what God's angels are supposed to look like? Of course, they didn't look like any pictures I had ever seen of angels with the wings and the long hair and a robe. They were dressed completely different. But I was trusting the scripture, and I felt peace and love all around me for some reason.
And your seven children, they were all in the house?
They were all in the house. They were in the living room sitting down along with my mother, and they were in a state of suspended animation. Now, evidently, the beings or the leader had put them in that state, because then after he had jumped back, I thought knowledge tried by fire. The only thing I could think of was the Bible. It's been here for a long time and proven to be true. And so I told him I had a Bible in the living room there, and we moved toward the living room. And at this point, there was only four of them. Evidently, the one had come in quickly and had gone over to where my father was, and I could not see that. But the four of them were standing there, and the leader said his name was Krasga. And I reached down for the Bible. Actually, it was my daughter Becky's Bible, because my children were going to the People's Church, and the People's Church gave each one of my children a Bible so that they would learn about the Lord. And I also, of course, would talk with them about the Lord. And so, anyway, I reached down after the Bible, and I passed it to the leader. He put it in his hand, and he waved his hand over it, and three other thinner books appeared, and he passed them to the three that were beside him. And they held it in their hand, and without moving the pages moved automatically, but there was no print whatsoever on it. It was just like bright white light, and it seemed as if the three beings that were standing there were consuming whatever it was by their eyes, through their eyes. And after that, he gave me a thin blue book. Now, at that point, I was still concerned about my children and my mother just sitting there in that suspended state. And the leader took must have known how my feelings were, because the leader took my daughter, Becky, out of it. She stood up. She could not move, but evidently she was seeing the transaction going on of the thin blue book given to me. And I was told it was an initiation, and that I was able to keep it for 10 days, and I was to grasp as much as possible out of the thin blue book, because then they would take it back, or it would be gone.
Let me just jump in here and remind listeners, Betty Andreessen Luca and her husband Bob Luca are joining us on the line to talk about one of the most celebrated, well-documented alien abduction cases ever. Now, it's interesting that your sense was that these may have been angelic beings, and yet, based on your description, it almost sounds as if they weren't familiar with the Bible, because the leader, it sounded like you said he made copies of it somehow. And
right, he waved his hand over it, but the Word of God tells us also that the angels would like to know what the Father is doing. And evidently, they don't have all that kind of information.
Okay.
Now,
right.
Why they did that, I don't know exactly, but that is what happened at that time.
Now, your father was not in a state of suspended animation. In fact, he was the first one to see these five humanoids.
Right.
How is he reacting at this point? I mean, you seem to be very calm.
You know, the thing is, I went through regressive hypnosis to get a lot of the information out, because I remembered an awful lot of it. But the thing was, my father also had seen the beings, and the researchers were asking if they could speak with my father. And I asked him, Daddy, would you please talk with him and tell what you saw? Because he had told me about it. But he says, no, Betty, I don't want to, because he was afraid that, you know, the government would get involved. Him being the man and me just a young woman, he'd probably get the attack.
Well, it's his fear.
He was worried that his Social Security would be taken away from him.
Well, his fear of government involvement turned out to be true, as we'll discover. Betty and Bob, hold on. We'll get Bob Luca in here as well to discuss the Andreessen affair, the true story of a close encounter of the fourth kind, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Question everything. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome back. We're discussing the Andreessen Affair, the true story of a close encounter of the fourth kind. And Betty Andreessen Luca, her husband Robert Luca, joining us on the line. And we will get to you, Bob, because you enter the picture a little bit later, obviously, when you married Betty. But I want to get back to your father for just a moment, because he was, again, the first person, Betty, who saw these odd-looking individuals, these five. And his initial reaction was he thought that they were children dressed in Halloween costumes, correct?
Yes.
Right. And at some point, did he leave the house and go outdoors?
Not to my knowledge.
No, he didn't.
No.
Okay. All right. So he didn't actually see did he see the source of the light? Did he see a craft? Did either of you see a craft of some sort?
I don't think he would have seen the craft itself, because after they took me out there, the craft was on the a slight hill, like right in the back of our house, and there was a smaller window in the pantry area, and then the larger one was toward the front, and he just saw them coming down like a slight part of the hill and then disappear into the porch to come into the house. That's what he had remembered. As far as him seeing the craft, he saw the reddish orange light that was flashing through the window, however. He did not go to the back smaller window in the pantry. He went immediately to the right, where it was out front, because he didn't know what it was, if it was the police department or the fire department, just as I felt.
And you mentioned this insignia on the these humanoid on their uniform. Was it a bird or an eagle?
Yes,
wasn't it?
It was like an eagle. Yes, it looked sort of like a small eagle. The wings were smaller than what you imagine on an eagle's frame. But, I mean, it was, it looked like an eagle to me by the head.
Now, some people have described, let's assume for a moment that these were gray, these are grays.
Right.
Some people have described them as being sort of unfeeling, sort of, cold, almost robotic. Did you get a sense of any, the word humanity is not the right word here necessarily, but did you get any feeling that they were empathetic, sympathetic, that they were feeling beings?
Yeah, I felt as if they were aware of everything that was going on, because when they heard, evidently in my mind, I was concerned about the children, and they took Becky out of that suspended state. She was standing there, could see, but was not moving around. Why I say this is because 3 or 4 days later, after everything had happened, she came to me and she says, "Mommy, I keep on having a strange dream of strange people in our house, And when I had been given that blue book, I put it in my bedroom, in the bedroom closet up on a shelf, and I wasn't supposed to show anybody it. But because Becky, I was worried about Becky seeing it and not able to let her know the reality of it, and so I thought, I'm going to have to show her at least the book. I wasn't going to open it up so she could see it, but to at least see it. And I told her, "Please, honey, don't tell your brothers or your sisters, because I don't want them to be afraid. But they were here, yes, there was strange people there." And I brought her into my bedroom. I took the thin book down from the shelf in my closet, and I sat on the bed, and I held it in my hand, And she was amazed over it. She touched it with her hand. And when she did, she lifted her hand, and there were all sparkles all through her hand from it. And ever since then, she has been able to write a strange language, and I think it must be theirs. It just forms. She can just write it out. And I think that it is trying to show people something.
Why did they presume that you would be able to understand what was written in that book if it was written in this language? What were they, like, pictographs, hieroglyphics?
Well, they were pictures. It were pictures of, it looked sort of like parts of the craft. There was a strange writing in there, I think, because, you know, I would pray to God, please let me understand this. As I moved the pages, after page after page, and I just was praying to God for me to understand why has this happened, and if they are angels, let me please understand some of the writing that is in there, because it was unusual.
At some point, you're taken aboard a craft, and eventually you find yourself on what you believe was the mothership. Can you explain or describe that experience?
Yes, I stood out front with them, and Quasgar was the name of the leader. He raised his hand, and when he did, the lower half of the craft became a sort of transparent, the outer shell, and I could see what it looked like underneath, like the parts. There was like three stemmed orbs, large crystal orbs on the bottom, and there was a smaller crystal orb on the top. And then there, on the metallic stem, there it reached out with armatures, and it grasped a crystal wheel. And there was this tube or something, a circular tube that was around these three strange machines. So I saw that. And I've tried to remember in my mind and draw down as much as I possibly could so people would understand what I saw, because it's impossible to say it just by words. By having the pictures there, it helps you to understand more what was going on.
Right. We should point out that this is in the Andreessen Affair, The True Story of a Close Encounter of the Fourth Kind, written by Raymond Fowler. You may be familiar with the Watcher books. And Raymond, of course, an experiencer himself. You underwent a rather interesting examination. At one point, you were submerged in liquid while sitting in a chair.
Yes. This was before I was taken to an unusual place. Two beings were with me. They were dressed in silver suits, and I went into a Quonset hut-type room, and there were eight chairs all together there, and they were like sort of plastic or glass. There were four on one side, four on in the other, and there was a track, a black track that ran through the middle, and they placed me in one of these chairs, and they gave me something very sweet to drink, and they put a thing so that I could breathe, and then liquid was filling the seat that I was in. And the researchers thought, well, perhaps it was something to transport me someplace, and I needed to be immersed in a liquid or something so no harm would come for me. This is what the researchers thought it might have been. But after it was finished, they opened it, they drained it out, and the liquid, and then they opened the chair, and then I was to stand up, and one of the beings were in back of me and one in front of me, and we just suddenly started to move along the track, and we came up to the door and out into a cave-like area. And as we did, it was very dark there, and the two smaller beings put these black hoods over their head. They did not provide me with one, but we moved along the track, and I could see I was in a cave-like, a long, narrow cave, but there were some openings on the sides of both sides of this cave, because I could see darker areas even though, because of their suits, actually, that's the only thing that seemed it was shining, and that's the only thing I could see, you know, where we were. As we moved along, we came up to like a mirror, and we went right through the mirror into a red atmosphere. And in this strange red atmosphere, there were buildings. There was no vegetation, but there were these strange-looking creatures in there that had, like, by the neck, it had two stems and big eyes at the end of those stems. And they were moving all around, almost like they were sort of like what frogs would be able to hold on to something and
right.
move around.
This is the red creature. We actually have a picture of it now up on the live stream, if people want to look at that. For those who have joined our Hangout, Betty, Andreessen, Luca with us, and Bob, we will get to you. Thank you for your patience. We're coming up at the bottom of the hour here. We have a couple minutes. I want to move things along here. And how long do you think you were aboard that craft? Do you have any way of knowing?
Not really.
Okay, but when you were returned to your home, you had no memory of that, of what transpired. This was all recovered later through...
Well, no, I had a small memory of just a person, one of the beings, being in my house. This I remembered way up until we had moved from the place and we had built our own big house, and it happened that I got a newspaper article that Dr. Hynek had out asking any... one with something strange happening or craft or whatever, to please write to him. And all I had the memory of at that point was the one being with the big gray head with the black eyes and being dressed in a suit. And so I wrote the information down and I sent that in to him. Now, he filed it away in his files for 3 years. And then a group of researchers, along with Raymond Fowler, had inquired of him if he had any, like, people or beings.
Humanoids,
type creatures that they could look into, because that group was studying that. And that's how it all began, because... they got in touch with me, asked me if I would undergo regressive hypnosis. Now, the thing was, I had that memory of the being, and so I wanted to find out, and I said, yes, that might help me to understand what I saw. And then when I was put under regressive hypnosis, the information just flooded out of me. I was at times left open. The hypnotist left me open so that I would be doing some dishes or I'd be sweeping the floor, and all of a sudden I'd remember some more of what had happened. So it just came flooding out of me after. It was in my subconscious mind. Of course, we keep everything in our subconscious mind that we see or do and all our surroundings and so forth, but it seemed as if through that regressive hypnosis, that tool, it helped to open up my memory of what had happened.
And I guess you have talked about that perhaps they implanted some knowledge in your brain which would come out later, and in the interim they had placed some sort of an amnesia block in your mind.
Right. Well, during the process of when I was taken aboard the craft, that was that they put me in the liquid, and then we went through the red atmosphere, and we were on this black track. Well, through the whole process, the thing is, I there was so much to remember there, but as I came before this bright light in back of a bird, and I thought it was a huge eagle, I was a little fearful at that time. Also, what happened was the light was so strong. I think I passed out at that time, because what happened is I remember waking and seeing a large hill of, like, ashes and were burning, and like a worm came out of them. And there was such a bright light there, and a voice spoke to me and said, I have chosen, first of all, it called me twice, and then it says, I have chosen you to show the world. And so I think that is the information that has been implanted in me to let people know what I went through and what is beyond what our understanding of our earthly life is concerned. There is more to life than we could possibly realize.
All right, Betty, stay put. When we come back, your husband, Bob Luca, coincidentally, or perhaps not, also underwent a rather interesting experience in 1967, pulled from his car. Another abduction case. And he'll join us when we return. The Andreessen Affair, Betty and Bob Luca, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away.
Don't be afraid of the dark. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free in Ontario at 1-866-740-4740.
I get a tremendous amount of email asking about the bumper music that brings us in and out of the breaks. And by and large, most of it is Danny Elfman, whom I consider to be one of the greatest composers of the latter half of the 20th century and the first half of this one, for my money, Danny Elfman. So a lot of that music comes from various film scores that he's been involved with. Before we get back to our conversation with Betty and Bob Luca and the Andreessen Affair, it's time for our weekly Follow the Truth trivia question. Your chance to win a pair of tickets to my live stage event, Follow the Truth 2, happening Sunday, April 26th. That's an evening event at the beautiful restored Regent Theater in Oshawa. Tim will take the seventh correct caller. The seventh correct caller at 416-360-0740, 416-360-0740, or toll-free, 866-740-4740, 866-740-4740. Here's the question. Keeping in mind, one of our presentations will be dealing with the Shroud of Turin, and we'll have an exact replica of the Shroud at the event. Who was the first person to be allowed to photograph the Shroud of Turin? And it was this individual's photograph which demonstrated that the image on the Shroud is in fact a negative image. Who was the first person to photograph the Shroud of Turin? Again, be the seventh caller, the correct caller, through now at 416-360-0740 or 1-866-740-4740. And I'll be seeing you at Follow the Truth 2, Sunday, April the 26th, the Regent Theater. For more information, visit followthetruth.tv or call the box office at 905-721-3399. All right, back to Betty and Bob Luca, the Andreessen Affair. Betty, I mean, if that wasn't life-changing enough, that would be enough for most people for 10 lifetimes. Right. Your life was turned absolutely upside down again.
It sure was.
The father of your children disappeared. Mm-hmm. You lost two sons in a tragic car accident. Your father passed away.
Yeah.
And how were you able to cope with all of that?
It plus, was the Lord Jesus that has gotten me through all the way, even till now.
All right. I want to work Bob in here. Bob, welcome again, and thanks for your patience.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me the story. This is a short segment. We've got about 4 minutes here, and we'll pick it up on the other side with you. But how? First, tell me a little bit. Give us the Reader's Digest version of your abduction experience, coincidentally also in 1967, and then explain how you and Betty hooked up.
Sure. Well, in 1967, I was on my way to the beach. It was a beautiful, bright, sunny day. I came to a quarry, and there was a railroad spur going into the quarry, and there were five men working on this railroad spur. But they weren't working. They were all looking up in the sky. So I looked up, and much to my amazement, I saw two huge cigar-shaped craft, very bright, like polished chrome reflecting in the sunlight. And they were headed from where I was, they were headed toward New Haven, Connecticut. So I pulled my car over because obviously these were not airplanes. They had no wings, no tail section, no windows, no exhaust, no noise. So I pulled my car over and I watched as they were traveling side by side. And then two smaller disc-shaped objects actually dropped out of these. One went off toward New Haven, one went in the other direction. I thought, wow, that's interesting. I watched till they were out of sight, and then I resumed my trip to the beach. And this was in a rural area. There were no houses in that area at the time. I got down the road a few miles, and one of these saucer-shaped craft came back, and it was pulled over to the left-hand side of my car. It came down kind of like a floating leaf motion. It stopped several feet above the ground, and I remember looking at it, and all of a sudden there was a brilliant flash of a deep red light, almost like a ruby ray laser. And somehow this light took me inside this craft. And inside, there was the first thing I saw was one typical gray, and they had on a red skin-tight uniform with a lightning bolt emblem on the left chest. Four others came up from a lower area of the craft. I was asked to remove my clothing. I was put on a table that I can only compare today to possibly plexiglass. And this was a very strange table because there were no restraints whatsoever on it. And yet, it was just like I was super glued to the thing. I could move my eyes and my head just a little bit.
Okay, Bob, I'm going to jump in here and we'll take a time out. Back on the other side, we'll resume with your harrowing tale and then find out how you and your wife, Betty, hooked up. Two experiencers, both abducted in 1967, now husband and wife. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
When in doubt, blame the government. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
When you look at the sky, ever wonder if someone's looking back? This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. To speak to Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free in Ontario, 1-866-740-4740.
Hey, thanks for hanging out with us. Congratulations to Teresa Sheldon, who's in the 905, so somewhere sort of in the greater Toronto area. Teresa's won a pair of tickets to followthetruth.tv, and she'll be joining me Sunday, the 26th of April, the evening of, at the Regent Theater. And, of course, for your chance to win, be listening every week at this time. And if you don't happen to win, you can get your tickets at the box office, 905-721-3399. Followthetruth.tv for more information. Teresa Sheldon, congrats. All right, we are talking about the Andreessen Affair. Can you see that, you joining us on the Hangout, if you can see the book there? And this was first published in 1979, 35 years ago, and now been reprinted. Is there new information in the book, Betty and Bob?
Not in the Andreessen Affair. However, Bob and I have put together a book. We've named it Lifting the Veil because I've had another experience with the one. And we've done summaries of the experience we've had and also how we have lived up until now. So the book is being chopped at this time. So.
Lifting the Veil. All right. Well, we'll be on the lookout for that. Bob, I can't unfortunately spend a lot of time talking about your abduction, but I think we got the basic details. But how did you and Betty manage to hook up?
Well, 10 years later, I had taken a trip around the country with a friend of mine. We was looking for work out of state. We left Connecticut, and we went down through Texas, California, Washington State, and we were actually coming back to Connecticut. We're at a rest area, and for some reason, we decided to go to Florida, which was thousands of miles out of our way, round trip. I got to Florida, and my friend's sister-in-law lived there, so we were staying with her, and one evening during supper, she mentioned that she had known a woman that had had a UFO experience. And I said, God, I'd like to talk to her, because I had mine bottled up for 10 years. I told my parents and my best friend, and that was it, because I didn't want to end up in an asylum or something. So I went down to where Betty worked, and she wouldn't talk to me because the book's author, Raymond Fowler, told her, beware of reporters. It took me quite a bit of convincing, but I finally talked her into having lunch with me the next day. The next day we went out, I bought lunch for her, and I've been buying it pretty much ever since.
Funny how that works out, isn't it?
Oh, that's how it went.
Well, and do you, the fact that you both had your abduction experiences in 1967, is there something at work here, do you think? Were you being drawn together?
I think so, because we also had a child experience, and that was in 1944. So it seems as if we were drawn together.
Well, we should point out that Betty, prior to your abduction in 1967, you had other encounters.
Yes, I did.
Do you want to spend just a moment talking about those?
Well, I had, as a child... I was waiting for my girlfriend to come over to play dolls with me. I was outside in a little hut my brother had made. And all of a sudden, a bee came in the hut, and it circled me, and it was a tiny ball of light. It struck me in the forehead right between the eyes. I went down and out, and I heard a voice speaking with me, and it said, the wee little one is coming along fine, and that I would be very happy very soon. So after that experience, I'll let you know what Bob's childhood experience is. Bob will tell you.
Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, in 1944, my dad was overseas. It was during the war, and I was on a swing set in my backyard. And we were living at my grandmother's house. And I was on the swing set, and even as a child, I noticed an unusual light in the sky. And this light came closer and closer toward me. It stopped. It hovered above and slightly to the left of me. It had a domed top on it that looked like glass or plexiglass, whatever. As it tilted, I could see two what we would call typical gray beings in there today. And they told me through the mind that they were preparing something for mankind that would be good in the future. And they also said that people like me, having seen them, that they had visited many, many people, and in the future, these people would meet, which proved to be very, very true. And that was in 1944. So Betty and I both had experiences in 44, 67, and then 78. We were both taken together.
Talk to me first, Bob, and then I'll get Betty to weigh in. But talk about how various secret government agencies have invaded your private life.
Well, the first thing that happened when the book came out, I think the government was a little dismayed that people were believing us. And what happened was the very first thing we noticed was these black military helicopters, Huey UH-1s and Sikorsky Blackhawks, very low over our home.
There's a picture of that. Sorry, Bob. There's a picture of that up on the live stream right now.
Right.
Oh,
okay.
This is a photograph that you took in 1980, I believe.
Right, over our home in Cheshire.
Right.
Well, this became an everyday thing with us. Didn't matter if we were in Florida, Connecticut, New Hampshire. That was one. Number two, they brought in the IRS, and we had yearly audits until the fourth year when I overpaid my taxes on purpose, and that stopped. Our telephone was tapped. We were followed, and as a young fellow, I used to build race cars and race on the street because there were no racetracks near where I lived. Several times I was able to get behind the cars that were following us. We got the license plate numbers. I gave them to police officer Larry Fawcett, who was also a UFO investigator. They came back as unissued. So this is obviously government. On one occasion, Betty and I snuck out of the house at 3 o'clock in the morning, hooked up our camp trailer, and left. That was on a Saturday evening. Tuesday, two FBI agents with photo ID showed up at my job and questioned my supervisors and my coworkers as to where we were. Now, even right now, today, I have a case with the FBI against the Department of Defense. The United States Navy Space Weapons Division and the U.S. Army both hacked into my computer within 48 hours.
How are you able to determine that, Bob?
Well, I had been a computer technician, and I had some really good software. The software gave me the ID numbers, and then I went to Whois on online, and it gave me the computer ID, the physical street address, the owner's ID, the operator's ID, and I have a letter of admission from the Army Inspector General admitting that it was, in fact, their computers. Since then, I have tried to, I've gone through my congressman, I've gone to the United States Attorney General, and I have no answers yet as to why this took place. So I have asked the FBI to bring charges against them, because this is a federal crime, hacking computers. And I have the proof, I have the letter of admission, so now I'm just waiting on the FBI to hopefully, you know, be able to give us some information. And possibly, I've been told that the government can be sued for this. It's not, you know, we're not looking to make money on it or anything like that, but I would like answers, especially why the Navy Space Weapons Division is in our computer.
Now, we had invited you to join us on the live stream and appear on webcam on the HO, the Hangout on Air, and you graciously declined, explaining that you were nervous about appearing on webcam because you feel you're still being monitored.
Yeah, we don't use the webcam because my computer has been hacked a number of times in addition to that. So
yeah.
I didn't think it would be a good idea to have a webcam.
Betty, are there still experiences happening?
Yes, there is. I've had many more experiences in between. I had one where they put an implant within me, and that was then in 1967. They took one of those implants out of my nose. And they also checked me for procreation. But there was so much involved there. There were so many different times that we had some experiences. You know, there's five books that are written by Raymond Fowler about the different experiences that we went through. And now I have had another experience with the, and I'm finding out who the one is that I have been approached by.
Do you, either of you, have any regret about going public with your story?
Not outside of the harassment.
Yeah, just the harassment was, you know, that was terrible at times.
And Bob, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this. Obviously, the story's out there that this was a stepson. Was it your son?
Right.
Bob, who in 2007 came out and said that this entire story was a hoax. Could you address that for us?
Oh, sure. We did put a letter on our website, AndreasAndAffair.com. Robert did pretty well until when my father passed away. Robert had gotten involved at that time with drugs and alcohol, and he was, for some reason, irritated. He thought that my father should have left him the bulk of his estate, and he harassed me. He harassed the attorney that made my father's will. He harassed his brother and sister, and I finally had enough. I disowned him at that time. That was in 2005. I wouldn't talk to him. I told him, don't bother coming around. I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear from you. And I figured, you know, maybe after a couple of years, things would cool down, we get back together. Well, this was his way of getting even with me. Anybody that reads the stuff he wrote can see that it's just, you know, it's a total confabulation. I mean, he put in that I never had the report from MIT on the possible implant that came out of my ear. I've still got that right here in an envelope in my files. Pretty much everything we had done has been documented. A lot of the stuff we saw had been witnessed by the investigators as well. Even the psychiatrist who returned after a couple of years to talk to Betty again spent an evening with us at our home, and he himself saw two very unusual things happen. One, there was a heck of a noise in our kitchen about 2 o'clock in the morning, and no one was there. He stayed till about 5. We got out of the house, and we were talking in the front yard about 5:30, and this huge cigar-shaped cloud stopped over our house. While other clouds were moving, this one stopped. and it got thin. It was very thick in the center, and it got thinner out toward the edges. You could almost see the stars through it. And he finally looked at me, and he said, "Did you see that?" And I said, "Yeah, but I wasn't going to mention it until you saw it first."
Right, just another day at the Andreessen House.
Police Officer Fawcett, once he started investigating our case, he had the black helicopters over his house. He was approached by the military and asked to sign a secrecy agreement because
Unfortunately, we're out of time, Bob. I apologize.
Okay,
I have to jump
okay,
in.
No problem.
But Bob and Betty, I really appreciate the time you've spent with us, and I hope to have you back on if you'd be good for that, and we can delve into this further.
Oh, sure. Pleasure.
Betty and Bob Luca, The Andreessen Affair, The True Story of a Close Encounter of the Fourth Kind, which has been recently reprinted, of course, from 1979, written by Raymond Fowler. And look for Betty and Bob Luca's book, Lifting the Veil, hopefully soon. The website for the radio program you are listening to, The Conspiracy Show, is richardserrett.com. Check it out. Lots of great information there. Say hi on Twitter at Richard Serrett. And of course, as always, follow the truth.
Live from Toronto, Canada, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Thanks, as always, for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, your earbuds, whatever the case may be. Christos Anesti to all of our Orthodox Christian listeners. Of course, Easter being celebrated this past week by Orthodox Christians around the world. Our family, we broke our fast early Sunday morning at about 2 in the morning following the resurrection liturgy at All Saints Greek Orthodox Church here in Toronto. I say break the fast. 40 days without dessert. That was what I did for Lent. And, you know, that's tough for me, I got to say. But it's supposed to be. It's intended to be, you know, difficult. You have to give up something that's important to you. That's what Lent is about, right? So that we remember the sacrifice and the crucifixion. But come to think of it, the way I ate, I didn't break the fast. I smashed it into 1,000 pieces. And again today, the mighty Aphrodite makes this incredible traditional Greek Easter bread. It's called tzareki, and there's nothing like it. Albert and Eric, the interns, are in studio with me tonight. Producer Tim Spreen is in the next studio performing his technical wizardry along with Sebastian. So we've got lots of people hanging out tonight. It's nice. You know, to have the station filled with people. I often feel like a ghost here, I must say, at night when there's no one around. It's just Tim and I usually, but we've got some extra hands here. Get on up to richardserrett.com. Elbert has posted some fascinating stories in the slide carousel, an interesting exchange between Japan's defense minister and a journalist regarding incursions into Japanese airspace by unidentified flying objects. And conservative columnist and ABC commentator George Will, who's one of my favorites, says it's official. Richard Nixon, in fact, committed treason during the Vietnam War, according to a new release of extended versions of Nixon's papers in 1968 as a presidential candidate. Nixon ordered his liaison to the South Vietnam government to persuade them to refuse a ceasefire being brokered by President Lyndon Johnson. Again, remember, Nixon was a candidate in 1968, a citizen. He was running to be president. And he convinced his liaison in South Vietnam to intrude into official government negotiations with a foreign nation. That's against the Logan Act. So this traitorous act has been speculated about for years. And you guessed it, dismissed for years as just another crazy conspiracy theory. And now we have confirmation by none other than George Will. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, it's our monthly Paranormal News Roundup with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Rosemary will discuss recent DNA testing on a 19th century Russian ape woman. And we'll discuss the remarkable case of a murder that was solved by the ghost of the victim. And much more. That's paranormal researcher Rosemary Ellen Guiley at the bottom of the hour. Of course, Rosemary will be on stage with me at Follow the Truth 2, Sunday, April 26th, and she'll be performing a spirit communication experiment with her spirit boxes. And the Regent Theater, if you haven't seen it, right there on King Street, downtown Oshawa, a beautiful old theater dating back to at least the vaudeville era, so 1920s, and I'm guessing there must be some paranormal activity there. And hopefully Rosemary will uncover it live on stage. I've heard stories. If you haven't purchased your tickets, you better do it this week because time is running out. Let me give you the box office number very quickly. It's 905-721-3399. And for more information, of course, visit followthetruth.tv. There has been a lot of online buzz around some photographs that one researcher has called a smoking gun when it comes to proof that aliens are visiting Earth. And even though there are many articles and blogs and interviews and forum posts about these pictures, the public hasn't really actually seen them. However, they will be displayed during a special event hosted by a Mexican broadcast journalist in Mexico City, May the 5th. That's coming up. They've been labeled the Roswell slides and supposedly show what some say represents stunning visual evidence of a humanoid creature that was found crashed near Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. Here to tell us more are two of the foremost Roswell investigators, Tom Carey and Don Schmidt. Tom and Don, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Nice to be with you, Richard.
Good evening, Richard. Good to be with you again.
Don and Tom, yes, thank you for checking in. And we do have, there's Tom on the HOA. It's a great image. Good to see you, Tom. And we've got Don, you're on the phone.
Right.
We should mention that the two of you have co-authored a number of books, The Roswell Dig Diaries, Sci-Fi Declassified, Witness to Roswell, and Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson. Let me begin with you, Tom, and Don, you jump in when you feel appropriate. Tom, how did the two of you become involved with the Roswell slides?
It's an amazing story, Richard. It's almost 3 years ago, I received an email from the owner of the slides. Never heard of them before. And, of course, we've had approaches before from others that claim to have various items. And I wanted, without going further, I wanted to actually see what he had. And so we signed. We had to sign non-disclosures in order to see them. He emailed the images, and when I first looked at them, and this is like 3 years ago now, a chill went down my spine. That always happens when I receive new information, a new witness, something like that. Even after a quarter century of researching this case, I still get excited when new information is presented. And looking at these slides, to me, they rung true because there were things on them that had been described to us by witnesses. And it's an amazing story how the owner came to possess the slides because they are from the late 1940s. They've been authenticated. And that's how it came to Don Schmidt and myself was the owner had looked online. He was not a UFO guy, and he looked online under Roswell, and he came across our name somewhere along the line and contacted us.
And Don, could you explain how this individual that contacted you came in possession of these slides?
Well, I always emphasize for the novice that my partner Tom is just his dissertation away from his PhD in anthropology. And I was the first one to meet with the owner. I drove to meet with him. I spent the better part of 2 hours, so I was able to actually look and handle this evidence, these slides. And that's when, as Tom described, we were asked to sign the non-disclosure agreement, which we have professionally honored all these years. We've been criticized for it roundly. that we haven't brought others into our confidence. We haven't released information. We haven't released the slides. But again, we've been bound by this contractual agreement for no other reason than let's investigate them. Let's study them. Let's see if indeed they are depicting something extraordinary. And for Tom's background, when he tells me, as all of the other legitimate anthropologists who have examined these slides tell us that it clearly depicts something extraordinary, something beyond the pale, something beyond, you know, any human condition that many of the, again, novices have attributed to the appearance of the body contained within these two slides. I'm going to believe the experts. I'm going to believe Tom Carey, because that's his background. When he says, Don, this is something that does not represent any human condition, I stand with my partner. And that's why Tom and I spent the better part of the first year wrestling and going back and forth with the owner as to what the ramifications would be for going out on a limb, for standing behind something that is so extraordinary. And we realize that, you know, our careers are at stake here, our reputations, our credibility. And yet we've stood together since the beginning, and we will continue to stand together. But I guess what I personally do resent is that so many of the skeptics have practically, you know, called for a Roswell caliphate regarding the slides, that somehow they have done all they can to link them with Roswell. They're the ones who have labeled them the Roswell slides. We haven't done that.
Right.
And they are going so far as to say that, well, if the slides go down, so does Roswell. If Carey and Schmidt go down, so does Roswell. Well, that's nonsense.
What was it, Tom, that when you saw the slide, or Don, either of you, that you said that the image on the slide, there were the suggestions or that there was evidence there that linked it to other eyewitness descriptions of, what, alien bodies? What was it?
Yes. First of all, the overall appearance of it was in the slides. There's a woman standing beside the glass slab that it's lying on. The body appears to be 3.5 to 4 feet tall. The overriding feature is the large inverted pear-shaped head. But there's one item on it on the top of the head that was described by one of the first-hand witnesses, one of the first ones to the crash site, as a matter of fact, the fireman, local Roswell fireman named Dan Dwyer, who described when he got home that night and he told his family about it. They asked him, you know, what did it look like? And instead of giving a detailed description, he just said, child of the earth. It looked like the child of the earth. Now, to me, I'm a city fellow, born and raised in Philadelphia. I didn't know what the child of the earth was. Well, the child of the earth is another name for it's the Jerusalem cricket or a potato bug. Well, it's one thing, it's something on the head, and I don't want to give everything away here. I want people to...
Sure.
You know, tune in and watch it, and I will describe it in detail then. But there's something on the top of the head that one of the eyewitnesses described, and it's on this particular creature on the slide. And there's no way anybody could have known that. Anybody that was hoaxing something like that could have known that. And it jumped right out at me, and I said, oh, my goodness, that's why Dan Dwyer called it the child of the earth. And it's there for certainly myself to see, but and I will describe it in detail.
Okay, Tom, Tom and Don, stay put. We will continue to talk about this incredible photographic evidence, a slide purportedly of some alien creature. We'll find out more When we resume our conversation with Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, RoswellInvestigator.com is the website, and the books Inside the Real Area 51, The Secret History of Wright-Patterson, Witness to Roswell, and The Roswell Dig Diaries, Sci-Fi Declassified. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away.
Question everything. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome back. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, our paranormal investigator, joins us at the bottom of the hour right now. Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, Roswell investigators extraordinaire, join us to discuss the Roswell slides. And as Tom and Don pointed out, this is a term that is being used by the skeptics, the debunkers, that are trying to link these slides purporting to show the image of an alien body, perhaps, on some sort of an examination table that were discovered a number of years ago. These are the terms used again by the debunkers, or the term, Roswell slides. And Tom and Don are issuing the caveat that, listen, they are not linking these images to Roswell. And the Roswell UFO crash incident does not hang on the, the evidence, whatever that may be, regarding these slides. Now, it's possible, though, that there is a connection here. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. Just for the dating of the slides from 1947 to 1949, and as we will be demonstrating at the event in May, that there were specific areas that the photographers visited during that time period that were clearly linked to Roswell, and the fact that both of them worked not only in western Texas, but also New Mexico at that time. And I think above everything else, the circle of friends who they associated with. And I don't think it's news to the general public at the moment, the fact that they were very closely linked to the Eisenhowers, President Eisenhower, who was chief of staff of the Army in 1947.
In fact, these slides...
It would appear that they were granted certain privileges at that time. And it may indeed have stemmed from Roswell. But that, again, the slides cannot prove that.
No.
So we can only speculate.
And the individual who is in possession of these slides, how did he discover them, and where did he find them?
The owner of the slides, first of all, the couple that took them the wife was a Midland, Texas lawyer, high-powered lawyer in Midland, Texas. Her husband was a field oil geologist, as Don said. Part of his territory was New Mexico, and the slides came into the possession of the current owners in around 1990. The husband died in 1982, and the lawyer wife died in 1988. And during a clean out of their house and the garage, one of the people who was part of the cleanup crew discovered this huge box of color slides, Kodachrome slides. And she said, oh, these look interesting. So she kept them. She took them instead of taking them to the dumpster. She took them for herself because nobody wanted them. And the couple had no children, so no one claimed them. So she kept them. And she didn't look at them for a number of years. And she finally looked at them, and these two slides in question were separated from all of the others. There were over 400 slides in total, but there were these two that were taped in an envelope to the underside of the lid to the box. So she looked at those and she got spooked. She says, "Oh my goodness, I don't like these," and she shipped the whole box to her relative, who has them now. He was no UFO guy, but he looked at those two slides and he goes, "Oh my goodness, I don't know what this is." I wonder if there, you know, anything to do with, you know, he had heard about Roswell, and this is just 3 or 4 years ago now. And so he looked at them and said, oh, I better contact somebody who knows something about this because I don't know anything about it. So from date of discovery, which was around 1990, until we got involved was 3 years ago. So that's how long we're talking about.
Explain how this is going to play out on May the 5th and the unveiling of these slides.
Well, Richard, even before that, I'd like to at least explain so many of the critics again, why has it taken you 3 years? Why has it taken so long? And the greatest obstacle, the biggest difficulty we've had, well, there actually have been two. First of all, it's like possessing a piece of physical evidence, a piece of debris, for example, from the crash site. And you just can't mail it, ship it across the country back and forth, asking experts to look at it, to examine it, to analyze it. So as we have traveled from one end of the country back and forth, trying to find experts just to take a look, examine, tell us what this is. And as the MUFON consultant in anthropology told us, you will not find a single American scientist who will give you an honest assessment of this. So, and we have found that to exactly be the case. They won't even look at it. They refuse to even look at it. And it's one of the reasons we've had to rely almost strictly on foreign experts, foreign scientists, pathologists, anthropologists, forensic experts. And this will be part of the event, part of the program in May, that all of these analytical reports, all of the analyses, all of the named experts, as well as the photographic experts who examine, there's a placard very fuzzy that cannot be legibly read by the naked eye, yet we've had everyone from Dr. David Rudiak to Studio Macbeth, even the photo interpretation department at the Pentagon, as well as Adobe, have all told us that it's beyond the pale, that it cannot be read. It's totally up to interpretation. So we truly feel we have performed due diligence. We've done everything we can to substantiate and prove what is contained within these slides, whether it is something of a human malady or something truly extraordinary.
And again, how will people be able to see this unveiling?
It's going to take place in the 10,000-seat National Auditorium in Mexico City, but it will be streamed worldwide over the Internet, and they can access the streaming for a small fee, of course, at the website www.bewitness. That's B-E-W-I-T-N-E-S-S. It's all one word, www.bewitness.org. They can access the internet stream by going to that website.
And what time will that be on May 5th? This is going to stream live, presumably.
That is a good question, Richard.
It's Central Standard Time, but we're going throughout the entire afternoon into the early evening. So that information would all be part of that live stream site.
Okay, and again, the website, if people want to watch the stream again?
www.bewitness, that's B-E-W-I-T-N-E-S-S, bewitness.org.
And why Mexico City for the unveiling?
Well, Richard, as Don said, the American media were not interested. They were not interested. American anthropologists were not interested.
Tom, why don't you just mention, just the way you practically had the door slammed in your face on occasions.
I will Richard, that two anthropologists that did give us an opinion were Canadian. And they will be highlighted in the rollout as well. But we are thankful for that. One lives in Toronto, as a matter of fact.
Ah, fascinating. All right, right, just not far from where I'm sitting. Okay, or somewhere in the city where I'm sitting.
Yes, I won't tell you who it is, but he lives in Toronto. Actually, Kingston, but he's in Toronto quite often.
All right, where do you place these slides in terms of the accumulation of evidence over the years for extraterrestrials visiting this planet? I mean, we have things like the Twining memo and eyewitness accounts from Roswell. Where do these slides fit in terms of their importance in your mind?
Well, for all of the experts who have been brave enough to look at the slides and for their constantly reassuring us that it is of no human condition, nothing that they have ever seen before, over 400 pictures, 400 mummies, for example, mummified remains have been examined, have been looked at. Those have all been eliminated. I mentioned the forensic experts, the pathologists that have looked at the slides, and they can all tell us what it isn't. I mean, the final conclusion may indeed be this is not human. This is not of any human, condition that they have ever seen. Can we prove it's an alien? Well, a picture, unfortunately, can't do that. We don't have the DNA. We don't have a tissue sample. We can't do that. But for those who are open-minded, objective in their reasoning as to if they can accept that we're not alone, that we are being visited, they're had to have been pictures taken. There had to have been people who were availed an opportunity to see what was recovered, and possibly at Roswell in 1947. And we're not going to be the group of individuals who always live by the motto, anything but extraterrestrial, anything but E.T.
Richard, if I could jump in just for a second, as far as the importance of the slides, they are right up at the top, because the skeptic's position is, well, show me some physical evidence. Well, we can't bring in a taillight or a turn signal from the crash craft, so a document of some sort would be paramount, and we would consider a photograph as akin to a document. And given the age of these slides and what they looked like, I would place it right above the so-called Ramey memo, which is heretofore a smoking gun of the Roswell incident. I would consider this one step above the Ramey memo smoking gun. This would be also a smoking gun type of piece of evidence.
Well, where there are two slides, perhaps there are more, and where there are slides, perhaps there is. 16-millimeter footage. I mean, do you hope? I'm guessing you would say yes. That there are, there will be more people coming out of the woodwork at some point.
As we have often even named individuals in our books, who comes to mind immediately is Frederick Benthal, for example. He was a photographer from Washington that was brought in to take pictures of the recovered bodies. And we have named other photographers who were brought into Roswell, who were assigned to photograph every phase, every step of the retrieval, of the recovery operation. So we know there is film. We know there are thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of photographs for such a monumental event. And now, or even our colleagues to say, well, yeah, they took pictures, but why should we believe that you guys managed to acquire a couple slides? Well, we'd love to believe the idea, just as you mentioned, Richard, that if there are two now, there could be more, and that this possibly may open a spigot, at least that may provide additional information that substantiates what we're going to release in May.
May 5th, 2015, you can watch the live stream at bewitness.org, bewitness.org. There's a small fee. And on that date, May 5th, they will unveil these slides. You will see the images on these slides. And this could be a very historic occasion. Mark it on your calendar, bewitness.org. Tom Carey, Don Schmidt, RoswellInvestigator.com, thank you so much for this.
Thank you, as always, Richard. Pleasure speaking with you.
Pleasure is all mine. Tom Carey, Don Schmidt.
Next time.
Absolutely. Thank you. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, our Paranormal News Roundup on the other side. Keep listening. The Conspiracy Show.
When in doubt, blame the government. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740. The truth will set you free, but first, it will really tick you off. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome back. I always look forward to this time of the month when we receive a visit from one of the leading experts on the paranormal. She has written more than 60 books, published by major houses on a wide range of paranormal, spiritual, mystical topics, including 9 single-volume encyclopedias. Her work is translated into 15 languages. She's worked full-time in the paranormal since 1983, researching, investigating, writing, and presenting and teaching. Her present work focuses on interdimensional entity contact experiences of all kinds, technological and mediumistic spirit communications, spiritual growth and development, problem hauntings and portals, or geographic areas of intense paranormal activity. She spends a great deal of her time out in the field conducting investigations and research. She's done groundbreaking research on shadow people and the djinn. Rosemary Ellen Guiley has studied energy healing, completed advanced training in bioenergy under Mitek and Margaret Wierkes, level 1 soul healing under Francesca Czarnicki, and therapeutic touch under Dolores Krieger. She's a Renaissance woman, and I'm happy to say that she's joining us at our Follow the Truth Summit coming up on April the 26th. Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, how are you?
I've had a terrific weekend in Kent, Ohio, Richard, at a paranormal conference, a terrific crowd. I was very well received with my presentation on the djinn. I'm happy to report that more and more investigators are taking note of this subject and incorporating it into their own research.
Well, they're following your lead, Rosemary, because to my mind, you have emerged as the world's foremost authority in this fascinating area, the djinn.
I certainly have. I never planned it that way, but it's worked out that way. I have done groundbreaking research on the djinn, and it really has captured a lot of attention.
Well, one of the things that you pointed out to me many years on this program, and obviously you've written about this, is that you believe that the djinn may, in fact, lie at the root of most paranormal activity, including shadow people, even alien abductions, which leads us to our first story in our Paranormal News Roundup. And we go to China for this one. China, of course, the world's most populous country, was one of the world's leading economies, a huge army. But it does lag behind in one particular area, and that is in alien encounters. I mean, there's been a number of high case or high profile UFO sightings over airports and so forth. They've shut airports down. But we don't hear many cases of alien encounters until now. And tell us about the case of this Chinese lumberjack who claims he actually slept with an alien. And this is not a joke. This is not off the cover of the Weekly World News.
It's said that he's the first person in China to have slept with an alien. I suspect not. I suspect there have been many cases in China. They're just not reported because ufology is not very well supported in a country. It's kind of tolerated, but I think many people are afraid to come forward. These alien encounters are worldwide, and why would China be excluded from that? But here's the story with this fellow, and it goes back to 1994. He and his wife were living in a very rural area. Local legend has that people there were kind of, a little on the crazy side because they were so isolated. But he claims that one night he saw a flash on a nearby mountain, thought something had crashed like a helicopter, and he was going to go salvage the metal. And he gets out there and is knocked out and has missing time. And then later, at a later time, then he has this really weird experience where
He wakes up, he's floating over his bed while his wife is sleeping beneath him, and this enormously tall, over 6 feet tall, alien woman whose thighs, inner thighs, are covered with this long braided hair, gets on top of him, and they have sex for 40 minutes. And then he has another experience where he also floats up over his bed, goes through a map that he has hanging, is taken aboard a spacecraft where he's told that in 60 years, a son is going to be born, who is, they hint that it's going to be his son, a Chinese peasant son. So the story is made public, and he really is ridiculed, like many contactees are, to the point where he's often sorry that he said anything at all, and people said, well, he was drinking, or it was his imagination. These are common arguments immediately applied to contactees. But the elements of his story are very similar to other stories told by contactees around the world. So I believe that there's merit to his experience.
This encounter with, I believe he said she was 10 and a half feet tall, six fingers, this female, we assume, female alien that he had relations with. The details are quite remarkable. Braided hair on the inner thighs. Have you heard anything like this before? I mean, you say there are some parallels. What we've just got about a minute here, but tell me if you've heard any
there
of this
are.
Before.
And we find them in djinn cases, too, or unknown alien cases where people encounter human-like entities that are covered with long hair, and sometimes it's stringy. This is the first time I've heard of braided hair, but the long hair on human-like aliens is reported in not a great deal of cases, but enough to warrant it as a pattern kind of experience.
All right, Rosemary, we'll take a time out when we come back on the other side. We'll talk about a case of a Russian ape woman, as she was described, and now DNA or perhaps some other type of forensic evidence may suggest she was, in fact, a Yeti, and a scientific answer to the ghost phenomena. It may have to do with the very air that we breathe. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Don't be afraid of the dark. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll-free in Ontario at 1-866-740-4740.
When you look at the sky, ever wonder if someone's looking back? This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. To speak to Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll-free in Ontario, 1-866-740-4740.
And we are back with Rosemary Ellen Guiley. Let's go back to the 19th century, Rosemary, and there was a woman. She was called an ape woman, and now there's some suggestion. This was written up in the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom that this ape woman may have, in fact, been a Yeti. What can you tell us about her?
She was another big, hairy being and had these ape-like characteristics to her. She was incredibly strong, stronger than most of the men who encountered her. She could run as fast as a horse. She was had wild characteristics and animal-like visage on her face. And she was called an ape woman, and she was trapped by hunters. She was impregnated by four different men, so she has descendants. I don't think she was a Yeti. I think she was an unusual human being. In fact, a modern scientist who was able to get DNA from her descendants identified her as coming from Africa, but said she was very interesting because her DNA didn't belong to any known group. So the speculation was that perhaps her ancestors had migrated to the Caucasus. This was in a region that was once part of Georgia, and that they had been so isolated that they had never developed the way most other human beings had. It doesn't make her a Yeti, and I think that the experts are kind of looking in the wrong direction for this, because all the characteristics of the Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, these big hairy-like entities, they don't act like people. They don't leave DNA. They don't leave carcasses, bones, or any evidence. They seem to come and go interdimensionally. That's been one of the curious things about them. And no one's ever been able to capture any physical evidence that stands up to scientific scrutiny. All we have are subjective sightings and some photographs and controversial videos. So I think some experts here may be trying to marry two different things. To me, it's like fitting a square peg into a round hole.
The person who conducted the DNA testing, Professor Brian Sykes of the University of Oxford, analyzed the DNA of her four living relatives. These are grandchildren who still reside in the Caucasus region. And as you say, he found West African genes. But why then would he go on to speculate that perhaps Zena, as she was known, was somehow a Yeti? I mean, where does he get that from?
It's like the idea that if you're big and hairy, you've got to be related to Bigfoot. And it just doesn't compute. And in fact, we have other cases from the 1800s and even into the 1900s of wild hairy men being seen in various places around the world. In the 1930s, for example, there was a famous case of a wild hairy man seen in the hills near Vancouver, B.C., and many people saw this ape-like man who ran around naked, which Zana, the alleged Yeti woman, did as well, out living in the wilds. So these might be unusual people. And I think the professor is right about that. She's very unusual as a human being, but it just doesn't translate across this huge gulf into the mystery creature of Sasquatch, Yeti, the abominable snowman, these various terms for this other creature.
Rosemary Ellen Guile is with us, our paranormal investigator, who joins us once a month on our Paranormal News Roundup, and her website is visionaryliving.com. Get on up to her bookstore. She has penned no fewer than 60 on the paranormal, supernatural arena. Now, an interesting study by a U.S. university that shows there may be a possible link between the air quality of a room and the hauntings reported to have been in it or to have been seen in it. What do you make of this study, that perhaps spores or toxic air causing hallucinations may be at the bottom of hauntings, Rosemary?
Very slim evidence, and this is another big stretch in my book. There have been speculations on the effects of mold and toxic things in the air on other kinds of paranormal or crazy cases, like the Salem witchcraft hysteria from 1692 has been blamed by some experts on mold in the rye bread that they were eating. And there's evidence that, yes, certain kinds of mold in the air and food can cause hallucinations and fantasies in some people, but it's not enough to cover all ghost cases. And I think that these researchers here are on pretty slim ground. They might find some parallels, but it doesn't account for the haunting activity that goes on in millions of places, outdoors as well as indoors.
That's a great point. And the researchers are from Clarkson University in New York. And they admit, you know, that the links are not as well established at the moment. But they say many hauntings are associated with prime environments to harbor molds. But as you say, you know, there are hauntings in outdoor locations. Anyone who has been, for example, to a Civil War battlefield and recorded EVPs or photographed strange activity can attest to that. I don't think you would find mold outdoors in a battlefield. But, I mean, it's possible that in some cases that this could be the what's behind it.
Tenuous link.
Well, is that something that, for example, you might consider checking out? If you were investigating a haunting in a house, would you routinely check for a mold infestation?
I never have myself, and I can't think of any other investigators who've incorporated that into trying to identify natural causes. It would require some substantial testing of air quality. But here again, I don't think that you could link every single paranormal phenomenon to something like mold that might be floating around in an air system. And it would have to affect percipients on a fairly uniform basis, which paranormal phenomena do not. You can take several people in any given environment, and they're not going to experience haunting activity equally. You also have brand new homes where activity is reported because it seems to be linked to energy in the land. So here, the mold argument would just fall completely down.
That's a great point in terms of new constructions, because in this article, it shows a picture of the Frederick Remington Museum in New York, which is also known for its reported hauntings. I don't know if you've ever been there. Have you investigated the Frederick Remington Museum?
I have not.
But I'm looking at a picture of it, and it's completely modern and refurbished. You know, does not look like a place where you would, you know, you'd have a mold problem. Well, you know, it's perhaps worthy of further investigation. It may be one small piece of the puzzle. It's possible that, you know, certain hauntings could be attributed to that. But as you say, there is no way that you can account for all hauntings, places in new constructions, outdoors, and so forth. This next story is a remarkable one. I'd not heard this before. This is the story of a ghost who solved her own murder. Set the stage for us, Rosemary.
This is a famous case, and I've written about it in a couple of my own books. It's the only known case of a ghost that went to court to solve her own murder. And her testimony was allowed in court. You can imagine that happening today. This happened back in the late 19th century in a remote place in West Virginia, where a young woman named Zona Hester married a stranger who came to town named Edward. He went by the nickname Trout Shoe. He was kind of a ne'er-do-well fellow, and they married very quickly. And within months of being married, she was mysteriously found dead. And a servant boy found her in her home. It appeared that her neck had been broken, she was quickly buried. Her husband wouldn't allow a doctor to examine her, claimed it was an accident while he was away working. Zona's mother was very suspicious of her son-in-law, whom she detested. And she took the winding sheet off Zona's body and claimed later that when she went to wash it, it turned blood red. And this to her was a sign that foul play had taken place.
I'm sorry, what type of sheet was it?
It was the winding sheet.
A sheet
that wrapped around a corpse.
Oh, like a shroud, almost like a shroud.
Like a shroud.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so she managed to get Zona's body exhumed because she went to the authorities and she claimed that her son-in-law had murdered her daughter. Now, she had dreams on four nights. She wanted to know the truth. She was visited by the ghost of her daughter in her dreams over four nights, and the dead Zona explained in detail how Trout had strangled her. He'd gotten mad at her. He was had an abusive temper. He had strangled her and murdered her. Her description was that he squeezed off her vertebrae and squeezed off her neck at a certain vertebrae. It was a very odd description. Well, they dug up her body, and lo and behold, she had been strangled at exactly the spot where the ghost had claimed. So Trout was accused of murder, and he gloated that they would never pin any evidence on him. In jail, he talked about wanting to have seven wives, and Zona was the third wife, and, you know, he was going to get off and go on to marry four more women. The testimony of the dead woman was admitted in court. Now, Zona's mother, Mary Jane Hester, was told by her own attorney, don't say anything about your dreams because the jury will think that you're kind of touched in the head. Oddly, it was the son-in-law's attorney who brought up the experiences in an attempt to discredit the mother.
Right.
And it backfired on him. The jury bought the whole story, and Trout was convicted and sent to prison, where he died of illness about 3 years later. A lynch party tried to get him out of jail and lynch him. They were so upset.
So
he wound up dying in prison.
So there you go. The testimony from beyond the grave of Mary Jane Hester convicted her killer. Remarkable story. Rosemary, and you tell it so well. I appreciate it. Again, the website Visionary Living, and we're very excited that you will be up here in just 2 weeks' time for our Follow the Truth 2, our paranormal experiment live on stage in spirit communication. Thanks, Rosemary.
I will see you soon, Richard.
Bye-bye. And goodbye.
Right.
Goodbye to you. Goodbye to you all. Tim Spreen, thank you. Sebastian, the Albert and Eric, the interns, back next week with a brand new show. Hope to see you then. Move over, Aphrodite.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.